Everyone, thank you for tuning into the Postmodern Realities podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. It's September 2017, and you're listening to episode 49 of Postmodern Realities, and I'm Melanie Cogdill, managing editor of the Christian Research Journal. On this episode, I'm joined by Bob Perry, who has a master's in Christian apologetics from Biola University and is a speaker with the Life Training Institute and a contributing writer to our journal. In the 2017 Volume 40, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Bob has written an article for our Effective Evangelism column, which is a practical advice column on how to reach people of other faiths and of no faith with the gospel. Bob's article is called That Nuns May Not Perish. Bob, it's good to have you on.
Good to be here, Melanie. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Well, before we get started, I want you to tell us what nuns is. You use the term in the title, obviously, and several times in the article, and it's kind of a buzzword that's been in the media lately with a lot of different, you know, statistics about this group. So can you please explain to our listeners what you mean by that term?
Sure. It's a it's commonly used among people who study the demographics of this stuff, but basically it's just somebody who's an atheist, an agnostic, or someone who's says that they have no particular faith at all. It's a lot of times it seems like these aren't necessarily antagonistic toward faith. They just really don't care, and that's one of the aspects of that these people share in common, is that they're just kind of apathetic about religion in general.
So, you know, if you're like me, you've looked at a lot of these different statistics, and you're talking about the demographics of this group. I've read a bunch of articles over the last year or so on this group, and it seems to be that polling is suggesting that these, you know, people in this group who are saying that they don't really believe in God is increasing, as opposed to people who practice a particular religion. So do you think that means that in the United States we're losing the evangelistic battle?
Well, it is interesting. When you look worldwide, the number of religious believers is actually increasing. There are a lot of demographic reasons for that, especially in the Middle East and India, that drives a lot of the demographic data, because birth rates in those countries are increasing rapidly. So that even if they keep the same percentage of people who subscribe to some kind of religious belief flat, the actual number of people will go up. But then again, in Europe and Asia, birth rates are plummeting. In fact, 60% of nuns that worldwide live in China alone. Their population over there is older and dying off. So for that reason alone, the number of nuns is getting smaller. So in a worldwide sense, the religious believers' numbers are actually increasing. But in the U.S., it's the complete opposite. The number of nuns doubled between 2001 and 2007, and then a recent statistic I just saw, between 2007 and 14, it doubled again. So here in this most advanced society in the world, we have the number of religious believers, the number of nuns, the number of people who don't profess any belief in religion, is rapidly increasing. So it's more of a local phenomenon in the U.S. than it is worldwide.
And why do you think in the United States that this group is increasing as opposed to worldwide? I mean, obviously there are religions. I mean, Christianity is growing in certain parts of the world, but so is Islam. So why would this particular non-religious group be growing in the United States?
Yeah, like you said, Islam is rapidly increasing in the Middle East and India and Southeast Asia. But in the U.S., I think there are several factors that contribute to it. One of them is what I just mentioned, that we're a scientifically advanced society. We've got medicine, we've got technology that has made our life more physically comfortable. And I think that the kind of removes a kind of a felt tangible need for God from people. They don't see the need for something when they're perfectly comfortable just the way they are. Now, obviously, there are psychological and moral issues that go into that, but I'm just talking about the physical comfort of people who live in our country that kind of removes that need. And the other thing in the West is what Tim Keller, he's a pastor up in New York who's written several books. He's an apologist, philosophically minded guy. He's identified what he calls the implausibility structure in the West. And the difference between the way we think and the way, say, a Middle Eastern person thinks, it's implausible in the West for someone to accept the idea that any one religion can be true. So if you, your approach is to say, well, you have to believe in Christianity because I think it's true, they're going to reject that right off the bat because they don't think anybody can say they're true. Where in the Middle East, people have no problem accepting the idea that one religion is true. They just see Christianity as being corrupt or unjust or, imperialistic because we've invaded their territory or whatever the idea is. Those things don't exist here in the West. It's just kind of a completely different mindset about how people approach the idea of religion at all. So in that kind of environment that we have here in the United States, that is physically comfortable and where exclusivism is seen as a bad thing, the people who believe in religious ideas is rapidly decreasing.
So what about the Christian church? It seems, I was talking to somebody else on a podcast recently, it seems like the church in general, membership is decreasing and so forth. So do you think they've had any role in just kind of this downward trend of people being interested in religion?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this goes back in history, to the Enlightenment, I think, where we started to accept what I call, I believe I used the term in the article, a bifurcated world, where we've accepted what Francis Schaeffer talked about, the upper and lower story, where you see there's a difference between faith and intellect. There's a difference between the spiritual and the physical world, that we have divided the world, and people in the church are not immune to that. We in the church, even though we believe in religious ideas, for instance, we kind of separate those and accept the culture idea that that's a personal belief and that it doesn't really have any public where there's no public reason that we should have to tell that to other people. That's just something we keep to ourselves. So we've accepted this kind of anti-intellectualism in the church for years, and this is nothing, I'm not saying anything earth-shattering here. Anybody who's ever had anything to do with apologetics knows that, the resistance you get when you try to introduce apologetic topics into the church or talk about these kind of things. It's a real thing that I think greatly contributes to it, because people can see their religious ideas as a personal thing, and they have no right to, the term we hear is don't impose that idea on me. It's just like morality for religion. So we've accepted that a differentiation between faith and intellect, as if those two things are in competition. That's not biblical whatsoever, but it's there. And I'll tell you, I teach classes all the time. One of the things I do when I start out is ask people why they believe in God. And I don't care if you're talking from middle school kids to adults who've been in the church for 50 years. People won't make eye contact, shuffling feet. Nobody can tell you why they believe that, because they've never been trained to do that. So I think that goes a long way to explaining why this is, evangelism is so hard, is because the church itself needs to be evangelized to some degree. And I think as apologists, we've kind of brought that on ourselves a little bit. The way we go about, and I'm guilty of this, and most of us who have ever been involved in apologetics are guilty of this, where you're focused on winning arguments, spouting facts, giving a syllogism, the premise A, premise B, therefore the conclusion is Christianity is true. And we don't take the time to listen to other people to see why they might not believe or are rejecting Christianity. So we sometimes make it hard on ourselves for that reason.
You know, you were talking about the two different spheres that have kind of dominated how we think about the world in the West, you know, since the Enlightenment. And I was reading a book recently, and they were talking about those spheres, like, you know, one sphere has to do with facts, and in that is like science and things that are knowable data. And then the other sphere is things like feelings, but we put things in there like religion and also even something like prayer, so that even when Christians think about things like prayer, we unconsciously put them in some non-factual, non-knowable, like this other thing that's kind of, well, I don't know if I really believe in that or not. It's just your opinion kind of category. So I think that's really true in terms of how, you know, we tend to think, even as Christians, you're talking about people not understanding how to explain their belief in God. It's like we've really never considered some of these things.
Right. And I mean, even you just made me think of another example is miracles. You know, if we in the church hear of a miracle, at least my first reaction is to say, well, there's got to be some kind of scientific explanation for that. I mean, we're programmed to not to kind of be skeptical of anything that we can't explain for ourselves. So that's part of that barrier, too. And I think it's not just about competing facts. I mean, we're always going to have that. But when a young, say, millennial nun, one of these people we're talking about, when you try to give them a rational argument, a lot of times they're not even considering the evidence you're giving. They're in the back of their mind rejecting what you're saying simply because you think what you're saying is true, and they believe it's arrogant to think that. So that's a huge barrier that we have to get around, and frankly, it exists in the church, too. So that's a tough one.
You're listening to the Postmodern Realities Podcast from the Christian Research Institute and the Christian Research Journal. Today's guest is Bob Perry. In the 2017 Volume 40, Number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Bob has written an article for our Effective Evangelism column called That Nuns May Not Perish. To read his evangelism article, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is $39.50, and to subscribe online, go to equip.org. We've been talking about the nuns, and I just wanted to find out from you, what are some kind of characteristics or traits that would identify this group? What kind of things do they all hold in common?
It's hard to nail down everything they hold in common, but in general, it's more younger people. If you look at the statistics, there's a couple links that I provided in the article about who they are. And if you look at the age demographic, it's almost like a linear progression. For older people tend to be very low percentage nuns. And the younger they get, the higher the percentage of nuns are. They're educated. It's people who have been off to college and, you know, I'm sure other places, the CRI has talked about the college campus and how it's not just neutral toward Christian or religious ideas, it's antagonistic. So these same people who grow up in that church I was talking about where they can't answer why they believe things are then sent off to college, and they're just inundated by people who are antagonistic to what they believe, even though they can't explain it. And because they can't explain it, the next thing you know, they don't really see why they believe it at all. So they're young, they're educated, they're relativistic. They have bought into the postmodern idea that truth and morality are subjective things that are up to you to decide for yourself. They're distracted by, you know, don't have to really explain that much. You just walk into a restaurant or something and watch everyone on their cell phones, not even conversing with each other. So that is part of it. They're apathetic, as I've already mentioned. They're self-absorbed. And when I say that, I don't necessarily mean they're narcissistic, but they have been their entire lives inundated with social media, and it's kind of an intoxicating thing. So they don't really take the time to read books or to study things in depth. They just kind of go with, you know, whatever's trending on Twitter or something is what they will subscribe to. So I think that's it. Young, educated, relativistic, and self-absorbed, distracted by social media is a very good generalization of who the nuns are.
When we had, when I originally talked to Bob about writing an article for our effective evangelism column, it was around the idea of, you know, how do you reach the unchurched? And it seems to me this idea of, you know, just, I don't know, that Norman Rockwell painting of, you know, 1950s, you know, apple pie baseball and church attendance or something is not true for most people anymore. So what do you see, or are there any cultural barriers to evangelizing effectively this, you know, unchurched nun group?
Oh, absolutely. Some of them I've alluded to already is this post-truth mindset, this post-modern idea that truth is subjective. That's a huge thing because, I mean, obviously Christianity is, our claim is that it's objectively true through history, archaeology, science, all those different aspects of apologetics. We're saying that it's true for that reason, but these people believe, the culture has taught them to believe that you don't have to accept that. You can make up your own kind of little truth for yourself and construct your own kind of worldview, and you don't have to consider the idea that objective truth is out there. In fact, they're skeptical of those kind of people, as I've already mentioned, and they think you're being arrogant if you try to put that kind of an idea forth. We also, I think, in the church are guilty of, when we do evangelism, unfortunately, and this is a touchy subject, but some of the words we use, maybe the mannerisms, I don't know, for, you know, quote, church people, are either misunderstood or taken as a kind of a caricature of what a church person is. You know, for like the word sinner. You know, if you're out on the street corner, I was out running in Seattle a couple weeks ago, and there's a guy standing on the corner with a bullhorn telling everybody they were a sinner. Well, he's right. I mean, we're all sinners. That's not debatable. But we have to find a better way to try to express ourselves with the words we use that are more Christianese, I guess you would call it. That kind of turn people off. They're not going to listen to you because they either don't understand you or they've made a caricature of what a Christian is and you fit it, so therefore you're not worth listening to. So that's part of it too. This implausibility structure that I mentioned before that Timothy Keller talks about. These are barriers that the culture has constructed about what you assume, what the culture assumes to be true, and because Christianity goes against that thing, whatever it is, thing X, then Christianity must also be false. So there are, I mean, this is everywhere. I mean, homosexuality is a, you know, at the tip of the spear there. Views of women, individual rights, racism and slavery. Scientific credibility, you know, if you're a Christian, you can't be scientific, is what the culture believes, and this, again, exclusivism. So all of these are barriers, and these aren't easy things to get over. It's significant barriers that we have to overcome in order to reach somebody evangelistically.
So if we're thinking about all these different barriers that this, you know, group of people have, what could you recommend that would be a good strategy to just how to, you know, effectively engage nuns?
Yeah. I guess it's kind of a three-step process. And part of this is what Tim Keller talks about in his book that I was going to recommend later on. It's called Making Sense of God. That just came out in the last year or so, I believe. And this is kind of his process that he suggests. First of all, everybody loves Jesus. I mean, I have a friend who I converse with from high school. Maybe I converse with a little too regularly on Facebook about these kind of issues. And this person is always quoting Jesus, even though she claims to be an atheist. So people love Jesus. They just don't really understand what all the things Jesus taught. They heard the stuff that they like, so they cling on to that. So we have to try to break the stereotypes about Christians, and with just a short, gospel presentation that's vivid and talks about Jesus, the kind of guy he was, the reason that we follow him and how he changed the world, something attractive and compelling that kind of hooks them to want to listen to more. And then, once you've done that, then you have to try to dismantle that implausibility structure I was talking about, that whatever their issue is. And this requires listening beforehand. You need to listen to where they're coming from for the reasons that they give about why they, whatever this implausibility factor is that is leading them to equate Christianity with being false because it goes against it. I can give you some examples of that maybe a little bit later, but just to finish this, so you give a quick, compelling, stereotype-breaking gospel presentation that, and as I said, try to avoid Christianese as much as you can, just that uses Jesus to hook them and make them be interested. Then you start to deal with the implausibility structure that the person you're dealing with has expressed to you. And then, after that, then you can get more into the biblical narrative, and this is the third step, about the creation, the fall, redemption, how all that works, how Christianity solves or answers all those kind of questions. But if you try to, say, dismantle the implausibility structure before you've given them a reason to be interested in Jesus, or if you try to start giving them all the apologetic reasons and Bible arguments that you have before you've addressed those things, then their eyes are just going to gloss over. And they're just going to turn you off. So that's the suggestion, that I kind of got from Tim Keller as far as breaking it down into a three-step process. Compelling story, dismantle the implausibility structure, and then go in depth. And that is a way to reach through the barriers that our culture has constructed. I think it sounds very effective. Now, this isn't quick. This can take a long time. And, you know, there's no guarantee of success for you. All you can do is your part to try to introduce the person you're talking to these kind of ideas.
Yeah, you mentioned having some examples. I really would like to hear some of those, because I think for all of us, okay, that sounds good, but then we know the people who, you know, are in our lives who are extremely resistant to religion and, you know, would be, if not proclaimed atheist or agnostic, you know, some maybe hostile or just really kind of apathetic, don't want to engage. So what are some like real world applications to this that you can share with us?
Well, one that I was involved in recently was last fall, the Women's March. I got into a discussion with a friend about, what was going on with the Women's March, why they were doing it, and the politics of it is one thing, but there were a lot of assumptions in the Women's March that had to do with, were kind of revolved around Christian oppression, you know, the Christianity and the nation that we claim to be a Christian nation has oppressed women and held them down, and the wage gap and all that kind of stuff. So I started just asking questions about why this person believed that kind of stuff and what they knew about Christian history that had to do with women. And I kind of, as you know, this is back and forth. You talk about it here in a couple minutes and it sounds like it's just bam, 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 but this is over a period of weeks back and forth, just talking about the history of women in Christianity, how women actually birthed the rise of Christianity because they were treated well. They were brought into communities in early Christian history in the Roman Empire where they were, you know, the Greeks and Romans really knew how to abuse women. And Christianity was kind of a haven from that. So women were attracted to Christianity for that reason, and then because of that, they actually outnumbered men in early Christian history, and so the birth rate, they could choose their husbands, and the birth rate among Christians skyrocketed, and it was actually a demographic issue that helped Christianity conquer the Roman Empire. I mean, that's a nutshell view. You can read about, Rodney Stark talks about that in a couple of his books. What I'm getting back to is that the dismantling this implausibility structure about women was to give the history of how women were actually a very Paul helped women. Paul was sympathetic to women. It was women who the Gospels tell us, first announced that the tomb was empty. Women had a higher value than the surrounding culture, and because of that, Christianity grew. So when you say that Christianity oppresses women, you're not really talking about real history. So that was an example, and that led, I don't know where that's going to lead, but at least it led this person to think, and they admit it, I've actually never heard that, and I gave them a couple books to read, and who knows where that'll lead. But that's an example of what I'm talking about dismantling the implausibility structure.
I think sometimes non-Christians haven't really engaged with someone who might want a dialogue with them, not just, the typical zingers that we see or whatever, but yeah, actually engage with them. And around the same time, I was engaging with someone on Facebook about abortion also, in specific, because it came up because of the Women's March. And I started talking to them, through Facebook, not, using Bible verses, but more just some philosophical food for thought for them. And I don't think that anyone had ever asked them about that before. So, it's not like they're, became religious or anything like that, but it was something that they hadn't even considered because they had assumed people who are religious or Christian would just, start flinging all these Bible verses. So in light of that, in light of this kind of approach, would you say that, okay, we're being more in line with how the culture would do it? Like, we are not just boldly proclaiming the gospel and letting the Holy Spirit work by just, starting out with just, okay, Jesus is God, here's what, repent and be saved, kind of like that guy you saw, on the Seattle street corner?
Yeah, I think that's when I talked about the church has some culpability in this, I think that's one of the reasons. I mean, I've been accused of, you need to stop with all this apologetic stuff and just preach the gospel and the Holy Spirit will do the work. Well, nobody that I know disbelieves that. Of course the Holy Spirit is the one who saves people, but we also have a role. We have a job to do, and whatever part of that job we can do, that's what we should do. Jesus told stories in the Gospels. His parables were the way that he reached people, and that's no different than me telling the story of women through Christian history. Paul, you go to Acts 17, Paul wasn't just preaching the gospel. Paul went in front of a bunch of people who didn't believe anything that he believed in, but he knew their literature, he knew their poets, he knew their philosophers better than some of them did. And so he was able to use their own cultural story and show that it was best understood and fulfilled and finished by Jesus through the resurrected Christ. This was like mind-boggling to them. Some of them had never heard it, but at the end of Acts 17, it says some of them there at the Areopagus were believed and wanted to hear more from Paul, which is kind of astounding. I mean, that's like, somebody like me walking into the faculty lounge at Harvard and talking to them for a while and having them say, yeah, you know what, Bob, that sounds good. Let me hear more from you. I mean, it's amazing. So it's not, when I talk about this, with people who talk about how we to adapt our evangelism to the culture, we're not throwing out the Holy Spirit. We're not throwing out the gospel. We're just giving a way that's going to be effective. That's what's most important to me, is how can we be effective at reaching these people who don't have any motivation to listen to us at all?
Well, I certainly hope with our conversation today, our listeners have been, challenged to think through, just how they can be more evangelistic in an effective way with people that they know that are unchurched. Well, finally, I want to end with some fun rapid-fire questions for Bob. So you live in Ohio, so I'm going to ask you if you'd want to eat Cincinnati chili or Buckeye candy, but I probably should explain to our listeners what that is. So Cincinnati chili is like this chili-type concoction on spaghetti, but it also has things like cinnamon and stuff in there. I've never had it. It sounds interesting. And then Buckeye candy is just kind of like a peanut butter fudge, kind of like a Reese's type of thing, a peanut butter fudge with chocolate over it. So of the two, what would you rather eat?
I'm a Skyline fan. Skyline chili in Cincinnati. It actually, one of the secrets to their sauce is there's chocolate in there, apparently, and cinnamon, and they pour this chili over spaghetti noodles, and you sounds disgusting until you have it, and then you're hooked. So yeah, Scott.
Yeah, I just chocolate and cinnamon and chili on spaghetti. I don't know about that, but you're saying it's good. So are you a disciplined or organized person, or are you more like go with the flow and spontaneous?
I'm kind of disciplined and probably a little too much if you ask my wife, but yeah, try to be organized.
Do you collect anything?
No, not really. I have five kids. I spent most of my days collecting them, but yeah, no, just kind of following them around and keeping up with them, traveling to get to see them and that kind of stuff. I don't really have any collections.
Well, it's almost we just finished the summer. It's the end of August and getting into September. This is coming out in September. So did you go on any vacation this past summer? And if you did, where'd you go?
Yes, I did. We just got back yesterday from the Delaware Shore. We have a house. It's been in my family for many years in Rehoboth Beach, Delaware. And we just got back from there. Had a great time.
Well, that sounds fun. Thanks, Bob, for being a guest on the Postmodern Realities podcast.
Thank you. We'll see you.
Today's guest is Bob Perry. And in the 2017 volume 40, number 4 issue of the Christian Research Journal, Bob has written an article for our Effective Evangelism column, and it's called That Nuns May Not Perish. So to read his evangelism article, please subscribe to the journal. A 6-issue subscription is $39.50, and to subscribe online, go to quip.org. We'd like to hear from you, so please connect with us on social media. So like the Bible Answer Man Facebook page, follow CRI, Christian Research Journal, Hank Hanegraaff, and the Bible Answer Man on Twitter. Follow the Bible Answer Man on Instagram, and please subscribe to the Bible Answer Man channel that's on YouTube. If you like this episode, please subscribe to the Postmodern Realities podcast on iTunes, and we need you to rate and review our podcast. We appreciate that. And please share this episode on your social media accounts. Be sure you tune in daily to the Bible Answer Man broadcast hosted by CRI President Hank Hanegraaff, who answers your questions live on air. To ask Hank a question, call 888-ASK-HANK Monday through Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. In addition, head to iTunes and please subscribe to Hank Unplugged, which is Hank's new audio podcast. Follow Hank off the grid, where he has in-depth conversations with some of the brightest minds discussing topics you care about. So until our next Christian Research Journal author conversation, thanks for listening to the Postmodern Realities podcast.